Hi, this is Judith Holofernes, or if that seems hard to pronounce, Judith Holofernes. You are listening to the first ever English episode of my podcast, Salon Holofernes. In case you don't know me, I am a German language songwriter, author and poet. I used to play in a German indie rock band called Wir sind Helden, and I have been going solo for almost 7 years now, recording 2 solo records and going more and more indie along the way. On this podcast, I talk to artists of very different trades about the troubles and joys of making art. My first non-German speaking guest is my white whale, none other than the amazing Amanda Palmer. So, because I was being shy, Amanda very kindly agreed to read you her own introduction. What you are going to hear now is Amanda Palmer pretending to be me, reading in my voice a piece I wrote about her some 5 years ago. Enjoy.
Hallöchen.
Hallöchen. So shall we try you reading this, although it is like me saying how great you are?
I can handle that.
Might be weird, might be good.
All right.
Also, if like the English is whack, you just change it on the fly.
Okay. I sit in my father's garden, way in the back, hidden behind the big apple tree, and cry like a baby. I weep tears of profound emotion, of exactly, or finally, for fuck's sake. I would like to throw myself on the ground and shake my fists at the sky, but the horse grazing near me casts an admonishing glance in my direction. And so, instead, I weep silent tears, and they fall on the uncomplaining pages of an unassuming how-to book, The Art of Asking, by Amanda Palmer. That's me. A book about making art and selling art and the emotional and financial difficulties associated with both. But most of all, an earnest invitation to share, give, and, damn it, finally take what people want to give you. Over the next few days, I tramp through the countryside with my bewildered husband, walking much too fast as I pull him along behind me. I can't keep all this new energy to myself. The man bears up bravely to my enthusiastic harangue, takes my hand and says, "Oh," and I bought The Art of Asking after seeing Amanda's TED Talk on the same subject. There she speaks about her roots as a street performer, as a living 8-foot bride statue, and of how she learned from that to translate this attitude of giving and receiving to her later art. A 5-foot bride statue, I would have had to become shorter than I actually am in real life.
That's a typo. That's not me being stupid. That's a typo.
It's all good. In the late 2000s, when she was the lead singer of the Dresden Dolls and right in the middle of the promotional phase of the duo's first big album, Amanda Palmer left her record label. She'd freshly been deemed an underachiever, a non-starter with 100,000 copies sold because the overblown expectations of the record company didn't pan out. Shortly after that separation, Palmer raised an uproar with the first large-scale crowdfunding coup in music history.
Mystery.
Her fan base put up over $1 million for her first solo album. Amanda made a definitive and spectacular exit from the conventional record industry. The success, but also the shitstorm that followed it, the small-minded score settling in the media and fan forums, raised new questions. Did she really earn the money? Why the fuck not? Didn't the people give it to her of their own free will in exchange for things that they wanted to have? That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, it is.
Why are we so petty with regard to artists? Is art only worth something when the artist dies broke and alone, preferably riddled with syphilis in a poorhouse? And above all, why are we always engaged in hand-to-hand combat with the fraud police out in the world, but even more so right here every time we look in the mirror? From these considerations came the TED Talk, and from the talk came a wonderfully inspiring, life-changing book about the roots of this austerity and about a probable antidote. Questioning a scarcity mindset which blackmails us into submission, bullies us into accepting schemes and recipes for success which are not at all compatible with the essence of art. Competition, marketability, chart systems, advances, high bets with winners and losers. And in the middle of it, the artists who try to preserve their craft, the inner generosity, the fearlessness, the utter defenselessness that it takes to bring anything of real value into the world. Today, Amanda Palmer finances her art through Patreon, a subscription system in which fans can support their artists on an ongoing basis without having to swing wildly from one giant breakneck project to the next. An idea that makes my heart race. One that I've discussed with friends until my tongue was about to fall off. The gist of their objections? That would never work in Germany. We're much stingier with our money than the Yanks are. And no one's going to give money to you. You've already earned a lot of money back in the day with your hyper-successful band, Judith.
Yes.
People will not understand.
True.
We'll see. For now, I'm finally releasing my second solo album on my own label, Dering Ding Ding.
Dering Ding Ding Records.
Dering Ding Ding Records. Amanda has touched some sore spots with these probing piano-playing fingers of hers. It's true, unlike her, I've always been lucky with record companies and have worked in the best conceivable circumstances since the magical beginnings of Wir sind Helden. Nobody's ever really meddled with us. Also, at least with the first three of four albums, we made everybody very, very happy. You're going to have to tell me what happened with the fourth record.
It was very dark.
But despite that, over the years, I became increasingly depressed, feeling numb and heartbroken about being somebody else's show horse, about the art never being the actual thing, but always a means to an end. I have completely worn myself out trying to conform to other people's definitions of success, to the point of systems failure. And then along comes Amanda, and she looks me deep in the eyes and says, "You're not crazy, and also not ungrateful. You're only unhappy with a work environment that contradicts your mission. And yes, that has got to change." Fuck yes.
Yes.
That is so beautiful. Holy shit.
Thank you.
You almost made me cry.
That's, yeah, the main goal. Yeah, I made myself cry.
Good.
Yeah.
Do you know something?
Some things.
Most artists, like the vast majority of artists that I know and I'm friends with,
yeah,
don't understand me the way you do.
Oh, that touches my heart.
I mean, it is, I've been talking about this a little bit lately, but doing this, my system,
yeah,
the way I do it is, it can be incredibly lonely.
Yeah, I can see that. Like even talking about it was lonely at some point.
Yeah, like you'll be far away from society, off the grid in some cave hole.
I also feel that people who don't do this kind of work, they don't want to know how difficult it is. Well, I don't know.
And this also gets into part of why this, like this moving away from the machine system really upsets people.
It does, yeah.
Because people don't, it's almost like people think that it is the artist's job to protect the audience from how the sausage gets made.
Yeah, probably.
Because the audience is supposed to just feel the feelings and believe in the magic. And if you accidentally educate them into what the sausage making looks like,
yeah,
you're ruining their experience.
Some people
don't like it.
Yeah.
I think it's the opposite. I mean, I just refuse to believe that.
Well, it doesn't seem to be true for my audience. Like, I'm lucky like that. I feel
they're
that
into the sausage making.
Yeah, they're into the sausage making and they're into truth. And I think, yeah, like your people are. Like, they want the whole Amanda, and I hope they want the whole.
Yeah. Well, even last night, I mean, you watched me last night.
Yeah.
Like, tiredly, you know, like, I put out a, you know, 1,000-word, unedited, I didn't even go back and fix the typos,
yeah,
blog about how I'm going to take their money and, you know, discriminately give it to a writer they've never heard of, a photographer that I know, and I'm considering that art. You know, it's not permission-based.
No.
But still, there's this part of me that goes, send. And then I can't go to sleep because I have to rush back to the computer.
To see if they like it?
To see if they like it and to pray. Like, and I'm right 99.9% of the time. I know that the first 10 comments are going to be, do your thing. It's all good. We're here for you. We trust you. This is great. Oh my God. You're, you know, fuck the New Yorker. Fuck the New York Times. If they're not going to cover your record, we'll do it.
Do it yourself.
Right. Yeah. But I still, like, even after all these years and TED Talks and books and, like, freedom fighting, there's still that little insecure part of me that goes, wait, maybe I'm getting away with too much. Maybe this is going to be the moment where they all turn around and say, Amanda, you've gone too far.
So, like, that's the fraud police again, right? Or, well, like, a, some sort of
it is,
sublime...
It is. And it's also, like, it's always part of why I know I'm doing the right thing. Because if there isn't fear involved,
yes,
then it's probably not art.
Yeah, it has to be. It still has to be scary. Should we explain the concept of the fraud police?
Sure.
Because for people who have not read the book, like, I would never say that to any other, like, in any other podcast, but this is required reading on the Judith Holofernes Understand Me list. Yeah. Is The Art of Asking by Amanda Palmer, and it's. You should read it.
And you can read it auf Deutsch.
Too. Yes, it's called Die Kunst des Bittens.
Yeah, I actually think it's called The Art of Asking.
Is it?
Auf Deutsch.
Yeah.
Ich glaube schon.
But it's out there.
It's out there auf Deutsch. And it's also, it's a, if your English is okay, it's a pretty easy read. There's not a lot of complicated sentences in it. So the fraud police.
Fraud
to,
is
not to be confused
Hochstaplerei,
with
or there's a better word. Hochstapler Polizei.
Yeah. Not to be confused with the frog police.
Yes, that would be the nice, frosch, though.
The frosch Polizei, which is actually what some... So I had always had this little saying, like I came up with it, I forget, maybe, you know, with a friend or something. And then I had to give a university graduation talk.
Yeah.
At an art school. So all these kids are graduating. And I don't know if it's as much of a thing over here in Germany, but in the US, like, every graduating class has a speaker.
Yeah.
And I was the speaker for this art school in Boston. And this is what I talked about.
The fraud police.
I talked about the fraud police and how even at my age and even after 20 years in a really successful career, you still think that there is some force out there that's going to come authenticate you and make you real.
Yeah. Or not.
Or not.
Or I tell you well, that you are not.
And we live in a culture, especially, I mean, and I see this in different places at different times in different countries. There is almost like a cultural, you know, mandate that artists not quite be considered real.
Yeah.
And that you are kind of getting away with something that's not real. And as an artist who is also trying to make a living and ask for money and value your work and figure out the relative values of, you know, an offering to society that isn't really a commodity, like a shoe or a toilet or a bridge or a hotel. You have to really, you have to become your own authenticator. And this is the problem that a lot of musicians and artists run into is like, we keep thinking that if we do it right and we work hard enough, that the system will come along and be like, you win,
yes.
You're real.
And you've actually done art right.
It never happens.
No.
Ever. It has a lot to do, you know, a lot in common with, like, you know, general psychology and happiness, which is like, you cannot look to the outside.
Yeah,
for the authentication of self, you've got to somehow rejigger your insides so that the one who is calling you real
is you. Yeah.
And it's really hard.
Yeah. And you have to listen real closely to what feels right. Like, I think the things that you do, like, I am very, very immune to other people's critique when I'm really happy with what I do.
Yeah.
I think it's the only way to go. Really, like, the more, the happier I am with what I do, the more I'll be like, yeah, but that's what I wanted to do.
Yeah.
You know, and if it's something that I might, like, if somebody talked me into doing something and then I get shit for it, that'll crush me because I'll know, you know, I'll be like, yeah, I know.
Yeah. You went against your instincts. Yeah. So I have an interesting thought about this, because there's this other narrative out there that is about, you know, Neil and I, my husband Neil and I, he's a writer. We argue about this a lot, because we have slightly different beliefs in this department.
That's interesting.
About why certain artists make certain art. And one of the narratives is, you know, when you make something, like you just said, when you make something that you're really happy with, like you're happy with it, you're satisfied with it. My argument is that you're happy with it and you're satisfied with it because you know that it is going to connect and resonate.
Probably.
Which is, well, so here's the argument.
What's Neil say?
Neil belongs to the camp of, like, even if I were alone on a desert island and, like, everyone else died in a nuclear holocaust, I might still have to write this book. And I'm like, bullshit. I call bullshit. Because even if you're a super introverted artist,
you want the connection.
We make art. Like, if you go back to the dawn of mankind, art is connection.
And communication. It's,
and communion.
Yeah, communion.
This is why we music. It's why we art. It's why we sculpt. It's why we dance. It's why we paint. And I'm not saying that there isn't a place for a different kind of art, because there are a lot of people out there who really are making art in their own isolated ways to communicate with God, to communicate with nature, to just do it for the sake of the beauty. And I'm not saying that that's not true.
But I think, like, when you say for the sake of beauty, you already touch on the fact that beauty and
is a
communal thing. No, I think it's like there's a longing, a human longing for beauty and truth. So I think that when you feel that something resonates deeply with you, you know it's going to touch other people, because it'll probably be deeply human. That's what I'm trying to say. Right. It'll touch on something that is not uniquely yours, but it'll go deeper to the other side, to the universal side of things.
And it points to, we are not not
alone.
The same.
Yeah,
we are not alone. Mm. We are not connected. We are not one. And if something resonates so deeply in your soul when you've created it, the idea of it not resonating with an other is unthinkable. So all of this, like, we're getting very, like, tangential, but all of this is to say, like, the, you know, the problem with dumping on top of all of this, the marketplace, and then, you know, and then the figuring out of how you commodify that sort of connection that we were just talking about is where things get very fucked up.
Yes, and very, very hurtful. And I think that's, like, the interesting point is, like, everybody's so surprised and then not when, like, some artist again kills themselves in a hotel room.
Right.
And, like, people have been going indie forever, right? But I feel what you have done is, like, really looking at why people need to go indie. I don't know, like, you've really looked at and named the things that are hurtful to artists and that are basically killing people sometimes, the ones that are already struggling, probably. I don't know, most of them.
Yeah, I think when you look at a lot of artists who have killed themselves, I mean, there's a million factors, right?
Yeah,
but
there's also, like, drugs, but the drugs don't come from out of nowhere. Like, they serve a purpose.
Yeah, they serve an escape and a palliative.
Yeah.
You know, and I think it can be so difficult for artists to live in the paradox of art and money.
Yes, absolutely.
It's so hard. And especially when you've got your, like, Amy Winehouses and your Kurt Cobains and whatever, where, you know, even if they wanted it, even if you want success, because of course you want success.
That's
because
not
you want,
the point.
Because you want connection and you want resonance. But then all of a sudden you wind up with this job of figuring out, you know, how to manage a massive commercial enterprise.
Yeah.
And your head spins because that's not really the job you wanted.
Yeah. I had people, like, at the height of our success, I had somebody tell me to basically get back in line, writing hits because there was jobs depending on it.
Yeah, and people with children to feed.
Yeah, and but they will like tell you that at an after show party.
Yeah.
And you'll be like, ha ha ha, what?
So what happened with your fourth record?
With the fourth record?
Yeah.
It's the one, it's not the one I like best, but probably one of the two that I love best. I really love the first one. And this is the last one we did. And it's really dark. And it's about, I think I was probably bordering on depression when I wrote the songs. And then I was so happy with the songs. Like, that's the paradox of art also, right? I'm like writing about the darkest shit. And I love the record so much. And nothing really bad happened with it. It's still like, because it was us and people still kind of trusted us. It still kind of sold okay-ishly, but it was definitely like our way back into being a legit indie band, I think. And I loved it for that. We had a British producer, so it was not at all like catering to German radio expectations.
Yeah.
Sound-wise also was really like, I loved it. I really love it. It's called Bring Mich Nach Hause, which is the main song, like take me home, bring me home. I was pretty crushed and I was crushing it, writing about it. So I love that
and
one.
And this is after you had both children?
That was after I'd had been touring. Yeah, I had been touring with two children I had been touring with one child for 3 years when I wrote it. And when we split up, it had been 5 years with two kids.
Wow.
And basically, like, I wrote that very dark record and then we went out to promote it. And while doing that, I was like, this cannot be happening. This is not okay. Like, I cannot sing about how like deeply broken I am and still be sitting here in a hotel room in Baden-Baden trying to sell it like this. Like, something is wrong. This is not, I'm not.
Can you talk about when you say like this, what do you mean like this?
Well, there's something about conventional music promotion that is very, it goes in
you
spurts.
Mean like this, like I'm sitting in Baden-Baden and there's 10 interviewers coming into this room and I just feel like I'm part of a machine.
I would be doing interview marathons, and it's not only those, because sometimes I'm good at those and sometimes I enjoy them. It's just like you hear the machine. You can hear the machine going clank, clank, clank in the background. And you know that there is no escape. Like, there's no you saying, oh, I've changed my mind. I don't want to do it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And also, I have wonderful interviews. Like, I've been lucky. I have been talking to really smart people for a lot of the time. But part of being a mainstream artist is also that you will have very low lows.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And sometimes it'll be the same day. Like, you'll have a very deep conversation about death and fear and art. And the next one is going to be like,
so tell me so about your influences.
Yes. And you've had a baby.
Yeah. So dude.
Yeah.
You know what I'm doing right now. You know the kind of tour I'm doing. I mean,
let's tell people though. Let's tell people what you're doing now.
I just put out a record in March that is like, by far the most like direct, dark dealing with life, death, miscarriage, abortion, my friend's cancer. There's very little metaphor on the record. It is a direct offering of human suffering.
Also, it's very gorgeous music, which is something that tends not to pop up in the press a lot because people are so preoccupied with the content.
Sure.
So I want to say it here. It's beautiful music. It's not like, it's not work to listen to it. It's still a beautiful record that you can listen to and enjoy.
Difficult themes.
Easy
listening. and not a coincidence.
Yeah.
You know, I wanted this record to be very accessible
and
to
beautiful.
People.
Yeah.
And so even though I am quote unquote, you know, independent, I still have that clanking machine.
Yeah, sure.
I hire publicists. I have tour promoters. I have tickets to sell. I have, you know, the same to-do list of check, 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 check. This is how you go out and promote a fucking tour and a record. Yeah. And my way of dealing it has just been like extreme humor. You know, like 2 weeks ago, in London, looking at my schedule saying I have 8 phone interviews with Luxembourg and Belgium and Antwerp and Stuttgart and like looking at Neil and our nanny in the morning going like, well, gonna make some coffee, gotta go talk to a bunch of European journalists about abortion, see you guys at noon, this is gonna be fun. And actually, you know, it's way more fun than it used to feel, because it used to feel like there was so much at stake and that I had to be so impressive and everything, you know, everything hinged on whether or not these magazines liked my record or whether these journalists thought I was clever. And the nice thing about having been in my career as long as I have, and, you know, and having made a record like this, that, and here we're coming full circle to what I was talking about, which is, you know, yes, I thought this record was awesome when I wrote it, you know, each song, but it's called There Will Be No Intermission.
Yes. So we and have I that on did, record.
And I didn't write it thinking this is amazing and it doesn't matter if no one ever hears it. I wrote it and thought the songs were great because I know my audience.
Yeah.
And I know my community. And I knew that these songs, especially songs like The Ride and Voicemail for Jill, I knew when I wrote them that the reason I thought they were good is because I've performed enough thousands of times that I could graft the reality of what playing that song to that room of people would feel like. And I knew it would feel real.
Yeah.
And that is a different measurement of success.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that's true independence. I think a modern kind of independence in music has to be interdependence. You know, like you go for connection and you depend on yourself and the people you are actually singing to.
Right.
And not everybody.
But this isn't a new concept.
No.
This is an old concept that got really, really fucked up when music became a commodity.
Yeah.
Because, you know, music didn't used to be about selling and buying. You know,
no, that's pretty recent. That's
super recent. Look at thousands of years of human history where the music got made and why and by who.
Yeah.
And you don't see, you know, there's definitely an exchange, but it was much more of a, you know, a community exchange, an emotional exchange, an exchange within the tribe of why this person happens to have this role.
Yeah.
You know, and I also think the more and more I think and talk with other artists about this stuff, the more I remember, especially like if you've studied any musicology or music history, it's really common in a lot of parts of the world for the music and the healer to be the same person.
The shaman. And that's sometimes like in my finest moments, that's what I feel like on stage. And it's like, it's not a delusion of grandeur or anything. It's like you're standing there and you feel like a healer kind of shaman people.
Yeah.
Like I'm even flirting with putting on a gown because I just love that feeling so much. Like putting on a golden kind of 70s funk era.
You just
want to
look like Stevie Nicks.
I do.
Yeah. But also to take it one step further, that's true. That like that is sort of like that feeling can come through us that we're there as the shaman tribe healer. But also like it's a job.
Yeah.
It's a shitty job like everybody else's shitty job, like with its good days and its bad days, and you fuck up your job and there are days where you wake up and you don't want to do your job.
Absolutely.
And this is also the problem of like the Kool-Aid that we were raised to drink is that like being an artist is fun.
It has to be wonderful all the time. That's not the point. Like that's what I feel when I'm when I get into like a complainy mode or people read it that way,
yeah,
that they'll be like, you should be so super grateful all the time. And I'm like, that's not the point. Like, I'm so grateful for the job that I'm doing. It's just that for a long time, something has been wrong with it, with the way that I have been doing it. And I like commerce in the way that it's when it's really direct. Like, I was a busker as a teen, too, like another parallel. I was busking from the age of 14.
That's why everything.
Yeah, that's why everything.
That is why everything.
Like, it's a huge, like, it's the best school in empathy and art. But also, it was the most fun I have had earning money ever.
It's so fun.
We've made more money than I ever expected with Wiesentellen. It was so much fun going home with the hat.
Counting my money.
Yes. And I think that's kind of what Patreon is. Like, you know that people who love the music or like what they saw or like the 8-Foot Bride give you money because they like it. Full stop. It's really easy.
It is a clean transaction.
Yeah, it is that.
It's clean energy.
And like, the just to explain maybe to people who are not so deep in the business side of things, I feel that conventional music business, especially with the internet now, is like you're supposed to make everybody like you a tiny little bit enough to give you very little money, right? You're trying to make millions of people notice you.
Yeah.
And you're kind of subscribing to the notion that attention is everything, even if it doesn't translate into money ever. Like, people are tricking you out of that bit. And I think things like Patreon are giving musicians or artists a way to say, like, I don't need all those people.
No.
I need the people who actually love it. And I can live off way fewer people's money that they give to me freely without me, like, making them love me so hard.
And this flies directly in the instructions that I was given in the 80s. And like, if I was in like a basic school of rock, growing up, I was born in 1976.
Yeah.
So I was forged in the era of the megastar.
Yes.
The Holy Trinity.
Madonna.
Michael Jackson, Madonna, Prince, my idols when I was 8. And that was the idea, is that if you did your job right as a musician, everybody would buy your record. And that was where you were aiming.
Yeah.
And yet I was really lucky because I quickly got an alternative schooling from bands like the legendary Pink Dots and and the punk bands that I was into and the folk artists and all of the people who seemed to know that there was a different narrative.
Yes.
That it was not about trying to please all the people all the time, but that it was about tightening your community and bringing your tribe together.
Yeah. And focusing on the people who want to actually love what you do, who are like to focus on the right people.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's like a, you know, this is the tightrope that we all walk, right? Because no one begins as the initiated. You know, you start with 5 fans and then you've got 50 and then you've got 100. But how do they come in? How do you find out that they're the right people? How do you get the word out? Where does that particular alchemy happen? And then when do you decide that it's enough? And these are really, really, really impossible questions.
They are.
For every artist. But also, I mean, I don't know if you've been following in the news lately, this Instagram influencer, Caroline Calloway.
No.
It's such a fascinating story. So she's one of those people who's famous for being famous, right? She's quote unquote Instagram influencer. But a lot of her followers, if you look at her metrics, a lot of her followers are bots and purchased and stuff.
Yeah.
And her ghostwriter from 7 years ago, who was like helping write the text to make her famous on Instagram, just wrote a big expose in the Cut, which is the New York magazine.
Yeah.
about, and she worked for 6 months writing this like 10,000, 15,000 word piece about their friendship. And it's also, it's a piece about class. It's a piece about commodity. It's a piece about friendship. It's a piece about drug addiction. Like, it reads like a soap opera. You're like, oh my God, the Instagram influence. But it also, it touched some really deep nerves in me.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, knowing that I still want to go out and find people.
Yeah.
Authentically is a really hard job. And one of the things that I, like, I've written about and talked about a lot in the last few years is like, I didn't like what was happening to me with social media. I didn't like the fact that I noticed that if I included a picture of my cute baby when talking about my tour dates, I would get 10 times as many things because the algorithm would pick up all the likes and the baby.
Yeah.
And I didn't like that I noticed on Instagram that like my best performing posts were of me with my hair done up wearing lipstick.
Yeah. But that's how it works. Like, I can write a brilliant blog post that I've been slaving over for 3 days and it'll never get the attention that I get with smiling.
Right.
Never. Never, ever, ever.
Right. And so here is where, here's the crux. Mm. And this is where our job as artists comes in. We can either follow the algorithm.
Yeah.
Or fuck the algorithm.
But that means going small. And like being fine with not competing with it.
And also occasionally gaming the system.
Yeah.
Like, I got into this argument again with Neil. We get like, this is one of the places where we don't totally overlap. We got into an argument about the Sex Pistols walking through London the other day because he, you know, he was sort of defending the system and saying like, if the Sex Pistols hadn't signed with a major label, you know, they just wouldn't have had the reach and the efficacy and the influence that they did. And I was like, I don't know. Like, I don't
also
know.
Also, maybe some other band that would have been even more.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Well, punk. And I'm also like, where exactly? Like, where do you really want to put your, like, which side of history do you want to be on? Do you want to be on the side of history of the Sex Pistols who were actually
a boy band?
A boy band and not about the right kind of values. And like, even if they convinced a bunch of kids to pick up guitars, like,
yeah,
exactly.
They
like,
did, of course.
But what was like, you know, what was the alternative? Like, what if the alternative had been that the Sex Pistols were actually like a really awesome punk band?
Yeah.
Who didn't sign with a major label, didn't drink the Kool-Aid and joke that everyone else should drink it. And instead, like, went on a real tour across America and across Europe where they didn't just fall over dead from drug use.
That's it.
Like, what about that? Well, and I'm like, that's, you know, careful what you argue for. Careful what you fight for. Because I don't know if you're fighting, like, even if that, you know, had an excellent trickle down effect, like, you could also argue that, like, Nazis built some beautiful buildings.
Did they?
But, I don't know. Yeah. Or whatever. Or that Leni Riefenstahl's films are great aesthetically. But, like, be careful what you argue for. Be careful what cultural spaces you want to, and narratives you want to fight for.
I think there's, like, I have a part of my heart that loves mainstream pop in like a detached kind of way that I can watch it and be entertained by it. And it's just like, it really isn't fun to do it. Like, parts of it are fun.
Have you done it?
Well, kind of. We were, I sometimes feel like we were like some sort of Trojan horse. Like, we had very non-mainstream content, but we sounded just mainstream enough to kind of slip through a door that was already closing. But we had radio airplay. And when I was writing about the magical beginnings, that was us being played on MTV and on the radio without having a record deal.
Wow.
We didn't have a deal, and we kind of tricked people. And still kind of made it. And then we got signed, which is, if you want to be signed to a major label, that's the only way to go.
Yeah. Get
right.
Get famous first.
Get famous first and have nobody.
It's hard to do.
Yeah. But have nobody be able to tell you that you have to change things in order.
Right, because so you can prove that it worked.
We were like, no. So that was brilliant. Like, we had the best case scenario of mainstream success.
When you went to make your second record,
yeah,
was there a lot of pressure
Oh my God.
To be more pop?
No, not to be more pop. And I was always good at, like, I don't know, making a bubble around myself and still writing whatever I wanted to be. So, no, I think we were still like sailing on that wind of people trusting us because we had obviously known better out of some weird instinct. It was more like an era of people trying to be us. Wow. It was good. It was fun for a while. And the thing is, like, still, we had those very, very, very good circumstances.
Yeah.
And still, it's just not good for the soul and not good for the heart.
What's not good for the
soul? Well, it's all fun and games until it's not. And there will be moments where you just, something happens and you don't want to play along. Maybe because you're hurt or something, you know? And that's the times when you will hear the machine in all its violence. I think there is some sort of violence to mainstream capitalism. It's just true. And you don't hear the clanging of the machine when you conform and when people are happy with you. But the moment you kind of veer from that path, it'll get very, very uncomfortable.
Oh, I know.
Yeah. And so, and then I had kids. Like, and I didn't quit. There's like a common misconception that we quit the band because of the kids, which is not true. The kids took so much of my focus and of my energy that I did not have the energy that kept me going the years before. But I shouldn't have been, you know,
yeah.
Before that, like, they gave me the urgency to quit.
Yeah, they smacked you with a perspective stick.
Yeah, they smacked me. And it was like, I cannot be doing this. I cannot, like, use myself like I have been. Mm. And I have to basically get happier to be able to have a life with kids.
Yeah.
And that's why I quit.
I mean, it's not, I didn't have kids yet.
Yeah.
But it's the same reason that we stopped the Dresden Dolls.
Yeah.
I mean, I think both of us knew, and I can never speak for Brian, but we were so successful. And everything was just ramping
up,
ramping higher and higher. And we knew, like, we could see where the whole thing was headed. And we were both emotionally destroyed, like, physically and emotionally. We had toured without a break. We had just, like, gone, you know, and when we talk about this machine, you know, I feel like there's a few different kinds of machine. There's, like, the gaping maw of, like, you must profit capitalism. And then there's just the machine of, like, you know, this is how a band tours, and you're just going to take the next offer and go to the next festival and go on another tour of Europe and go on it. And Japan is calling and Asia is calling, and you can say yes to everything.
And all of those things intrinsically make sense.
Yeah.
It's like everything, if you look at it, you'll be like, yes, but this is really important.
Right. Everything was so hard to refuse.
Yeah.
And
it'll all be good things. It'll all be important.
Right.
It'll all be the last thing you do before you take a break.
And interpersonally, Brian and I were not getting along. We, like, our relationship ate itself. We weren't having any fun anymore.
Yeah.
We were just, like, every day was a shitty day at work.
Yeah, oh, God.
Towards the end.
Yeah, that's kind of not why you started, right?
It's not why we started. And I hated that we were trapped. And I thought, you know, there is an exit door, but it means saying goodbye to all of the, like, delicious buffet of success.
Yeah.
And all of the money that's sitting there on the table. And even more importantly, like, the now, like, hundreds of thousands of fans who love us and have created this community, but, like, this voice from way deep inside of me.
Yeah, was warning, like, you.
you're unhappy mm-hmm. and it's not getting better.
And it's dangerous. I think deep down, you know that you are playing with real fire, with something that has the power to destroy like you or at least your capacity to do art.
Yeah.
Right? It's getting to the very core of what you set out to do. And it's going to kill your creative soul.
Yeah.
And that's when hopefully you notice that you have to get out.
Yeah.
While you still can.
So I got out after about as long, you know, the Dresden Dolls were like a hardcore everything all in band for about 8 years.
Yeah.
And then it just...
8 years.
About eight years.
That's quite a lot. It was, yeah, we did 12 years of being Wir sind Helden. That's a long time.
Yeah.
So that's three records. No.
Wir waren Helden.
Wir waren Helden for a while.
Wir wurden,
we had a good run.
Wir wurden Helden wären müssen sein sollen.
Yeah. But yeah, it's really parallel, I feel like. I loved that band. It was so hard to let it go.
You can still love it.
Yeah.
You can still do it.
I can still love it. Maybe at some point still do it, but the jury's still out
yes.
on that.
Like, well, you don't have to think about that now.
No. But there's things about the Patreon that I would love to talk about. Like maybe just to explain, the Patreon has people support you on a daily or monthly basis, mm-hmm. and you don't have to worry about a huge Kickstarter that might fail and send the money back to all those people and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So that's, I think it's genius. And I mean, we've been talking a lot about this, but I want to do it again on record because, you know, I read your book and I was crying because I had been wanting to do that for years already. Like I quit Wir sind Helden and I was sure that I was going to do something that would be really different from before. And then I didn't. Right. Like I did, and I took baby steps, and I had my own label, and I got more indie, and I changed a lot of things, and I'm happy with those things, but I didn't leave the system, or I didn't get far enough away from it. That's how I feel. Like I would feel like, you know, a child that has been planning like a child's game escape for weeks or months and hiding. Like a coffer.
You get a suitcase.
You have your suitcase under your bed with the candy bars. And I
and
felt
then you get to the drive end of the driveway.
Yes, that's it. And then a grown up steps in and takes you gently by the hand and takes you back inside. That's how I felt.
Yeah.
And what I would like to do is I would like to talk a little bit about why I didn't do it. And I want you to be like the fairy that I would have needed to tell me why. Because basically there was a lot of people around me who advised me against it quite adamantly.
Yeah.
And I'm a people pleaser. And so I didn't do it. And I'm very sad about that. But I'm doing it now. So fairy tale ended. But I want to read you the things that people told me why I shouldn't be doing it.
Excellent.
And I want you to diffuse them.
Okay. Are they all Germans?
They are all. Should I read them in the like stronger yes. German accent?
Okay. Just for me.
Okay. So and I feel like they fall into two categories. Like all the advice against crowdfunding falls into two categories. And you'll probably find out what they are. So first one is it's going to be so much work. And it'll come on top of everything else you already do. And you will not be doing things that you already do. Shit, I think it's true.
I hate to say it, but that's true.
True. Sorry.
But there's some silver lining.
Yeah.
Wie sagt man das auf Deutsch?
Ein Lichtstreif am Horizont.
Ein Lichtstreif am Horizont. It's true that crowdfunding means that basically you have to helm your own business.
Yeah.
There is not a magical label of people at desks making the phone calls, doing the budgeting. Like you have to do it. But
I have been doing that though.
Right.
Right.
But you get to do it.
Yeah.
And I would still always, if I had to choose between taking my hand off the wheel and putting the control in somebody else's office, someone who will not necessarily have my community's best interest in mind, my best interest in mind, it is a shit ton of work, but it's work that is worth it. It's the right kind of work.
That's it.
But it's goddamn hard working, honest American work.
It is. But and that's also, I think, really important. Like, I love working. And just very recently, I think I found out that I am not working too much. I'm working too little.
I'm don't working. Know if that's totally true
But the thing is, to clarify,
yeah.
I think I'm working too little where it counts. I'm doing too little art.
Yeah.
I'm making too little time for doing my actual fucking work, which is making art.
Yes.
And the thing is, it's not like you have to look at your amount of work, obviously, but doing work that is not right and doesn't feel right is soul destroying and will take up all your energy, and something that feels right doesn't.
Yes. And I mean, last night, so we slept together in this hotel room last night.
Yeah, let's set the scenes. We are in the weirdest
hotel room in Stuttgart. It's like a cross between an old grandmother flat and some kind of
IKEA madness.
IKEA Art Deco nightmare.
Also, you get lost. Like, you open a door and you never come back. It's really weird.
It's got there's a hidden bedroom. This place is very fucked up. Anyway, I just wanted to go to bed last night.
Yeah.
We had had a beautiful dinner. I was tired. You know, all I wanted to do was take a bath, get into bed, read my Jonathan Safran Foer book.
I was really quiet and to let you sleep.
And yes, you were.
Yeah.
You were sehr gut. But but I am behind on my Patreon blog posts because I'm on tour. A shit ton has happened. You know, I need to write a whole post about Paris and my Bataclan show. And I've hired this journalist team to come on tour with me. And I haven't introduced them yet, but I'm talking about them in my posts.
Yeah.
And, you know, journalists ask me this question all the time. Like, do you feel this responsibility now that you have Patreon? And I'm like, well, you don't really get it. Mm-hmm. I always felt this responsibility.
That's so true.
And I always wanted
the responsibility.
This responsibility.
Yeah, so because you're not alone. You're connected.
Right.
That's it. You have responsibility. Everybody does.
Right. I'm connected. And like, even though I'm tired and it's 11 o'clock at night, I like that work.
Yeah. It'll make people happy.
I like sitting down and writing an anti-media, oh my God, the New Yorker and the Atlantic are never going to write a 10-page piece on me, but fucking I can do it.
Yes.
I can hire an amazing young journalist and a super feminist photographer. You know, I can pay them each $5,000 and put them on my tour bus and be like, you guys are the fucking media. We get to say what the media is. Fuck these people. And writing that blog, I was like, I'm excited, but I'm so tired. And
excited, tired, excited.
Right. And, you know, a lot of my, like, weird journey, especially in the last 5 or 10 years, has been spending a lot of time beating myself up about the time that I don't spend making art and the time that I don't spend making music and the time that I don't spend doing the real thing, the real work, the real art. And then I finally was like, Amanda, that is the work.
That's your art. I mean, what I feel about Patreon, and that's just from watching you, like you are my portal into Patreon, is that it does something to you that keeps you constantly making art, but you don't have the threshold of it being big art all the time. It'll be a blog post.
Yeah.
It'll be writing.
It's a poem.
It'll be a poem.
It'll be a poem.
Yeah. But it keeps you churning out stuff and not being so prissy. And
well, and there's no approval system.
Yeah.
There's no office. That. There's no label listening to it. There's no marketing plan.
Yeah.
There's fucking nothing.
There's you and the things that you want to do.
Yeah.
And like, I have been talking for years. I've been talking to the wrong people about how my insides work. And it would always be like, yes, but that's not going to work. And I would be like, it doesn't necessarily have to. I want to do it. And that's totally different vectors.
Yeah,
you know, it doesn't compute. It's like, yes, but.
But they don't mean that's not going to work. They mean that's not going to sell.
It's not going to sell.
It's different.
It's not going to work out financially.
Right.
And I'm like, we'll see about that. I'm not so sure because I have made the observation that the stronger my stuff is, it'll attract some sort of money, you know, also like it'll work out. There will be money, but I want to do these things. And there's so many things that I haven't done. Like there's so many little abortions.
Yeah.
You know, like
artistic miscarriages,
okay, I'll go on. You are. This is, again, people telling me not to do crowdfunding. You are making yourself vulnerable to too many people's opinion. And you are too sensitive for this. You are too sensitive. It's going to crush you.
So
you are making yourself.
I have a clarifying question.
Yes.
The clarifying question for this person would be, why is Judith more vulnerable to anybody if she's crowdfunding versus just putting out records for critics to criticize and the public to criticize?
Well, they would feel that I would be pulling my audience even closer, which is like I've been very close with my people.
Yeah.
Always.
Yeah.
Which is why this all appeals to me so much. Yeah. I'm very cuddly with people and I have signing cues that go for ages and that kind of thing. So people would be like, you're letting too many people in. And they will be too close and they will all have opinions. I think the rationale is they are going to be paying you for this. So they will think that they are calling the shots and they will tell you to do this. And that.
I have lots of opinions about this.
Yes, please.
I feel like a New York Times fact checker.
Yes,
have
please.
Have you seen these new articles? They're mostly about Donald Trump. Where it's like, let's just fact check this speech.
Knuckle crack.
And, you know, five journalists just fact check.
Yeah.
And it is either this is true, this is false, or this is misleading.
Yes. Please tell me what is misleading about this.
This is misleading.
Yes, it is. Absolutely.
The New York Times says this is misleading.
Yeah.
There is truth to the fact that you will be opening yourself, making yourself vulnerable to ... What follows on that sentence is that openness and that vulnerability gives you incredible power.
Yes. And protection.
Yes.
It does. Yeah.
And it is, you know, it is like I have tried to explain this to people about my community, that like other people hire security when they go among their community. And my community is my fucking security.
Like you get naked and have people draw on your body. And when somebody gets weird,
yes,
a lot of people will take care of it.
Well, and I did a ninja gig in Graz 2 days ago.
Yeah.
And I didn't take security because, you know, 100 of my fans
are taking care of you.
Met up in a square and every one of them had my back.
Yeah, that's it.
You know, I could leave my bag and my ukulele there. And if a stranger came to take it, one of my fans would be like, that's Amanda's shit. Don't touch that.
Yeah.
And it is a jiu-jitsu move. And it is the prime difference in looking at fans as consumers that are separate from you versus fans who have to be kept at bay,
at a distance. Yeah.
Versus fans who you really actually do want to invite into your life.
And you trust them, like, because you trust that they like you for the right reasons.
Right.
And that they probably understand you better than a lot of people do.
And they don't want to feel like consumers the same way you don't want to feel like a commodity.
No, they want to feel like participants and, I don't know, patrons.
Yeah.
And it's wonderful being a patron. And I love it.
And like, community.
Yeah.
And family. Yeah. And this is the thing that I could talk until I was blue in the fucking face. But the label that I was on, that luckily I got off, they would they just never understood this.
No, and they'll always be focused on the fans that you don't have yet.
Right.
They're never focused on the ones that you have because those are like in the bag.
But even then, they really only looked at fans as sales. They did not look at them as family.
Mm.
And this was such a hippy-dippy, dismissible concept to them that had I been more weak-willed, I would have believed them.
Yeah.
But you see where it got me. And it is why when 25,000 people supported my Kickstarter, I wish there had been some hotline where I could have called up the label and been like, fuck
look
you.
Yeah.
Sorry, but I was right.
Yeah.
Because I
they probably got wind of it.
Well, yes. And also the label collapsed, not as right around the same time as they tended to do. But the point was, like, we're getting this wrong around the planet. The entire approach to life as transactional consumer commodity isn't working.
No, 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 no. Yeah, it's not.
It's literally destroying the planet.
Mm.
And our lack of desire to be interdependent is destroying the planet. And our lack of desire to be, you know, sort of messy and in a kind of a give and take that exceeds our base understanding of, like, I made a shoe. Me. It's $5. Fuck you.
I win at making shoes.
So, and I got to say, it's a very sort of patriarchal,
absolutely
male, you know, modern way of looking at things, which
and
is
everything,
like,
everything about the music industry is like from festival slots, like you have to be the one with the biggest balls who plays the best slots and make everybody else. I mean, the vocabulary is very like about male domination. It'll be they crushed everybody else. They lay everything to waste. They, you know. It's all about killing.
Yeah, music is war. And are you winning or are you losing?
Yes.
Yes.
And I've always felt like this is so wrong.
Well, but I think there's a reason that women are at the forefront of certain kinds of patronage, subscriptions,
absolutely,
and crowdfunding. Because women, especially like from the dawn of history and from the dawn of this particular system taking over the world's narrative, women have had to learn really creative ways of being interdependent if they were going to eat, if they were going to survive, if they were going to keep these babies alive. Like, we know it is in the DNA to know that you are not going to be able to fucking do this by yourself.
Yeah.
So I like looking at certain statistics in crowdfunding, men make more money, but women do more.
That's so interesting. I feel like, I mean, the conventional music industry is also crushing a lot of men who would profit from and want a more feminine, you know, organization or approach. I think it's just, it's all about competition, which is totally not what I signed up for.
Yeah.
But I mean, I'll read another one. Or this is maybe just like an appendix to that one, but you wouldn't want to be indebted to so many people and have to answer to so many people's wishes and opinions. So
this came up a lot
when
I did my Kickstarter. And I got that question so often that my head was spinning, because what the question told me is that people could not get their way of thinking out of a cold transactional. Oh God, what's the word I'm looking for?
Yeah, like it's a mindset. It's like,
well, but the mindset is a very particular. It's a greed based mindset.
Absolutely.
It works. That question works on a worldview assumption.
Mm-hmm.
That anybody giving me $10
needs to get $10 worth of art.
Well,
back.
Not even that. It worked on a weird worldview assumption that if my, and just follow me here for a second, that if I'm the artist and you're my audience and you directly give me $10 mm-hmm. for the record that's coming out in April instead of going to the record store and pre-ordering the record through the system, that somehow magically that means that because you've directly given me the $10 instead of giving the music store $10, you have ownership over the content and the direction
That's so
of
weird.
My art.
Yeah.
And nobody thought that.
No.
Out of the 25,000 people who pre-ordered Theater is Evil on my Kickstarter, not a single person said, because I have given you my $10, my $25, my $100, this is what kind of record I would like. Not a fucking person out of 25,000 people. Whereas, you know, if the average Madonna fan went to, you know, the record label or to HMV and pre-ordered the record over there instead of direct from whatever, Madonna's website, I have a feeling that it's more likely that that fan is going to say, I want an album that's sort of more like, you know, 1993 Madonna. Yeah. I really want sort of more like a prayer record. I didn't like Bedtime Stories. I kind of liked American Life. I really hope she doesn't do this. And who in any system, who has ownership over an artist's soul and voice? Nobody. Nobody.
Well, you have that in like, if it's corporate sponsorship, probably, you know, if you have Red Bull owning your ass, they might have an opinion about what kind of art you should make.
Well, so this is the paradox.
But people don't.
The paradox is that this question shows how backwards people's thinking is. Mm. Because if you are concerned for Judit or Amanda, that like all of a sudden people are going to have ownership over your creative voice if you go direct, nothing could be further from the truth. It is the closest you can get to actual freedom. Because if you don't think that staying within the system or using brand sponsorship or corporate sponsorship or label sponsorship is going to mean that you're safe from people's opinion.
Absolutely not. It's the total opposite.
It's almost as if people just don't understand the way it works when they ask a question.
Which
like
again
that.
Is the sausage being made.
Yeah.
I have more of these, but I'll read one more.
I want to do all of them.
It's fun. It's fun. Let's crush them. Well, this is
fact checking crowdfunding. Myths and realities.
Yes. I love this. But then I want to point out, I think, the underlying problem. This one says, it'll crush you. It'll crush you if it doesn't work. Mm. And it'll be visible. Like, it'll be another thing where I'm getting ahead of myself. But like, it's another thing where people will see whether you succeed or not in numbers.
It'll be a visible failure.
It'll be a visible failure. And you are kind of opening yourself up to your fans and asking for help. Mm-hmm. And if it doesn't work, it'll be the ultimate rejection and humiliation.
So, clarifying question for this, this fictional German person. What would failure mean? That only 50 people supported it, or 500, or 5,000? How are they defining failure?
Failure.
What does failure look like? Is it a number?
Yeah, probably. I think it's the same people who think this has never worked for anybody the way it has for Amanda Palmer. Mm. Like, that's the same people. And I know that to be true. And my expectations are way, way, way lower.
So
what is failure? Like, I've never been afraid of failure in that conventional sense. I just haven't. Like, I'm a scaredy cat. I'm scared of a million things, but not that. Yeah. I'm not scared.
Yeah.
Of failure. I know that humiliation hurts. I've been there. I don't want it. It's not nice. But again, if I'm doing something that I really want to do, it doesn't really matter.
So there's two things I would say about this. One is there is no such thing as actual failure.
But maybe probably like only six people backing your Patreon.
Yeah. I mean, there is a
misjudgment.
Well, I mean, there's a funny thing about that, because by some people's standards, you know, six people saying, I'm willing to give you money to make music is a success.
Yeah, sure.
Or 60 people, or 600 people, or 6,000 people, or 60,000 people. And then the question is like, well, wait, who gets to
decide?
Gauge? And
that's kind of also why you do it. Because you go out of that system of defining success by charts, like who wins Patreon, right?
Right. It's not about that. It's not like that. And also, I two more things. One, you are going to have what any artist trying to use this kind of system is going to have, which is you're going to have your early adopters.
Yeah.
Like the super hardcore, we have no idea, but we will fucking follow you anywhere you did.
Yeah.
Those people and those early adopters will be one form of, you know, one era of your Patreon. And then there will be the proof of concept. Mm-hmm. And then there will be the next wave of people. And then you'll go on tour and you'll talk about it. And there'll be the next wave of people. And then you'll put out a project that actually goes into the mainstream and people talk about the Patreon. And there'll be that wave of people. And at what point does this fucking person, like waving your note card in your face,
be like, it hasn't worked.
Right. At what point does that person say it's a failure or it's a success? It's, again, it's just bullshit. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of like saying, you know, like when the first Apple product came out, like it didn't sell 500,000 copies. It only sold 50. Yeah. So Apple's a failure. And it's like, well, no, it begins. And the thing about Patreon is that it's a marathon. It's an endless walk around the world with your community.
And that's what we want, right?
We want a long-term relationship.
Yeah, we don't. I mean, I totally want to get off the spurts and the, you know, massive effort for like the one record. And then you put everything in it and it keeps you from doing anything else for 2 years.
Yeah.
That's what a record with a record company is.
Yeah.
Like you get to make very little art.
Yeah.
Like 12 songs. And then you have to work for them for 2 years and not have the time to do anything else ever again.
Yeah.
And you'll be bored, shitless most of the time with yourself.
Yeah. Yep.
And that's mostly what I want from Patreon. I want a steady life of making art always. Yes, please.
Yes.
So that was, I mean, there's more of these, but I think the main like denominator is ego. And I think all of these things are people being worried for my ego because they are afraid for me. Most of these people are very nice people.
Yeah.
You know, and they are scared that my ego will get hurt. And I think that's very interesting because, like, I mean, you and I, we've looked into Buddhist thinking. Mm-hmm. And if you've done that, you'll get to a point where you kind of see that the antidote to fear for the ego is connection. Yes. It's like the more connected you feel to people and the more you understand interbeing, that you're not separate from everybody else, the less you have to protect your ego. And I think that's the main thing that people don't get about Patreon, that it's protecting you.
Yes.
From all of that.
Yes.
It's a protection.
It is almost like everyone is so used to a shitty system of separation that they actually do think that they're protecting you.
Yeah.
And they need to protect you from connection, because connection is dangerous, and connection makes you vulnerable, and connection exposes you, and connection, you know, why would you want connection? And then you look at these people's lips moving and you realize, wait, like, you're just frightened.
Yes. It's fear.
It is fear. And, you know, especially working on this record that I just made, and you saw the show that I did.
Yeah.
I have never felt safer.
I can see that.
I've never felt safer in my work. I've never felt safer in my community. I've never felt safer that even though I've only sold 800 tickets in a 1,500-seat venue, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
It'll be okay. I did my work. I did all I could. The message is still way more important than the number of the asses in seats. And also, financially, I'm totally safe. Because if everything falls apart,
The Patreon
will pay my staff and I have a salary.
That's amazing.
And I didn't totally know how much I was hustling as an artist until I switched up the hustle and really turned my attention away from convincing the world and the mainstream to accept me and really turned my attention towards my community and spent my energy with and on them. Ugh. And
it sounds lovely.
It's so fucking lovely.
Yeah.
And I still slave. I still work my ass off. I'm putting out 4 projects a
month.
Yeah, like
I've been with you for a bit and yes,
I work my ass off.
Yes.
But I really love it. And I think this is also part of like, you get a taste for what you're capable of. And once you get a taste for what you're capable of and you're on stage having that shaman moment, or you write something that really touches somebody and you play a show and you see a bunch of weeping people, you don't want to take a break.
No.
You want to like harness all of that power and keep using it and keep giving more and keep doing more and keep, you know, like, when you see that, like, you can push the wall of the system over a little bit and it budges, you want to, like, keep kicking at it. Yeah. And you've got this group of people who are, like, helping you try to kick it over. And that's, even though it's exhausting, it's really fucking fun. It's way more fun to work like this within this community of people with whom you have made yourself vulnerable than to be working with the people who don't get it.
Also, like, all of this applies to Patreon, but it also applies, I think, to making art, because I think the main enemy of good art is fear, right? Mm. And is self-protection, basically. Or it's one of the enemies, is that even the fraud police is built on the fear, like, of your ego being hurt. So I feel that every artist who starts out should try. I mean, the ego is something to befriend. It'll be there for a long time. But to kind of get a little more playful with the option of getting hurt. I don't know. Be easy with your flaws. I think the first thing that I would tell any like young songwriter would be get acquainted with your flaws and have a sense of humor about them.
Totally.
And be down with the fact that you are going to be flawed and people will notice. Because that's like the main thing that keeps you from doing shit, is being scared to be found out. So if you are down with like, I am flawed and it's fucking going to show.
Yeah.
Expect me to be fucked up.
What's really interesting nowadays too is that like, there's a strange paradox going out there in like the world of pop and self-help and the internet and Instagram and all this stuff, because there are a lot of really pristine,
flawless people. Yeah.
Flawless people. But it gets weirder. You've got these like pristine, super made up, super filtered, super high production people with like complete Botox and hard bodies, looking at you saying, it's really important to embrace your flaws.
Yes.
You should join my 10-step program for embracing your flaws. And it's like, wait.
Yeah.
Where the message is coming from and how it's being delivered is so confusing.
It is.
Nowadays. And you've got like, especially like there's a handful of female pop stars who are all about embracing authenticity, but the message that they seem to be sending isn't authentic.
You have to look gorgeous while doing it.
You have to look amazing. Yeah. And you're crushing it. You're crushing it. Yeah. You're crushing it.
And it basically means doing 10 hours of yoga every day.
Yeah. Which, you know, and again, no judgment.
Yeah.
But it can be very...
It's disorienting because it feels like it's possible and it's not. It just isn't. Full stop.
Yeah.
It's not possible for anybody to be that person.
No. And you have no idea what's happening when the camera is off.
Yes. So I think it's a political act or a very important human act to show flaws on Instagram.
Oh, I fucking and like to, I love it.
To post from your shitty holiday.
Yeah.
And to, you know what Jamie Lee Curtis did when she backwards photoshopped herself in a magazine? I don't know which one it was. It's years ago. But she had a photo of herself being almost 60 looking awesome. Yeah. And then she showed all the steps backwards to herself being 60 in her underwear.
Yeah.
And I think that's like the bravest, most wonderful thing that you can do.
And here's what people forget. And this is what gets back to your Kickstarter or your crowdfunding criticizer.
Mm.
That is power.
Yeah.
That is actual power. And this is what people misunderstand. People really think that the ability to put together the picture that looks good and that looks perfect is power. And
it isn't. It gives you a shit ton of stuff you have to protect, and that'll keep your hands tied. You'll be so busy protecting that, that it'll keep you from doing important things.
You're stuck in the makeup chair.
Absolutely. And you need your hands free. And it's so freeing to be like, yeah, I don't have to protect my ego that much, and I can do more important things. There's another category of advice. Let's call it advice.
Fucked up advice for you to totally
for
fairness.
Not going on Patreon or similar things. This is beneath you. You already are somebody. I think that's a different category, but I have heard that. Like, it's beneath you because you are a rock star. You already have a following.
That is so backwards. That's like telling someone that they shouldn't open a bank account because they're already so rich.
Yeah, that's it.
That just displays an entire misunderstanding of how the whole thing works.
Works, yeah. Totally.
Yeah, the sad thing about that is that crowdfunding, especially at this level, at Patreon level, it's not for beginners. I would never advise a band that is just starting out and has not played their first gig to ever enter into the arena of subscription crowdfunding, because it is for people who have communities.
That's pointing at me while saying that.
I'm pointing at you because I know you have a massive community. It is a community harness system.
Yeah, it's not something to build a community with.
No.
It's very important to say that, I think.
Yeah, and I mean, it's also, it gets very chicken egg, obviously. The bank account metaphor is actually really good. You don't start a bank account until you have $12 to put in it.
Yes.
This is like what your parents used to say to you when you're 10. Like
you save up some money.
You save up $15 and you put it in the, and then now you can start your first bank account, but you don't start your bank account unless you have $15 to put in it. And then like it accrues interest and your $15 turns into $15.10. And it's back and forth, and you put money into it and it makes money, and you put money into it and it makes money. And I know that I am using the worst capitalist metaphor in the world, but it's true. Or maybe it's not quite the same, but it reminds me of the people who tell me that they can't do yoga because they're not flexible.
Yeah.
And I'm like, you don't understand
the concept of yoga. Or I cannot meditate because my mind won't shut up.
Right. I'm like, right? that's why you meditate.
Exactly.
And this is just completely backwards logic. This is a person misunderstanding what the tool is
how it works. Yeah. That's, I mean, there's also, again, an appendix that was in the intro already. And that's, you already made some money. Oh, that didn't sound German. You already made some money in 2002. So people won't understand that I still want to make money from what I do now. And people will be like, you've made some money 10 years ago. And you should be happy and shut up forever. And be your own patron, basically. Basically, I think I'm my own Neil. You know, people have been saying that about you and Neil, which I think is the most sexist and awful thing.
Yeah, but why does she need to crowdfund? Because she's got a rich husband.
She's married to Neil Gaiman. Why should she? It's very similar, I think.
This is New York Times fact check says.
Yeah.
This is true. This is misleading. This is false. This is just false.
Yeah.
This is just plain stupid. Thinking, and I also got, I got this a little bit, but in like this, the backlash against my Kickstarter. And this is so fundamentally weird because intelligent people will say things like this as if they have no understanding of how basic economics work.
Yes.
Like, please. What do you mean you need to make money? You made money last year.
Yes.
As if the present does not exist.
That's it.
And that is, like, these questions aren't even really worth tackling because they just show so much ignorance on the part of people and how basic systems work, how artists need to continue to make a living once they have a hit, and so on and so forth.
And how much money it costs to make art.
Yes, which a lot of people don't know.
I think it's kind of weird, the kind of magical thinking that a lot of people have towards art.
Yeah.
And it's like when I explain like how much money I lose when I have to cancel a show.
Oh my God.
Oh yeah. My God. Like the money that I am putting at risk by doing this.
Yeah.
And it's true. Like I have made more money with Wir sind Helden than I thought I would ever. It's less than people think because we were so damn ethical and didn't take a lot of the money that was thrown at us.
Yeah.
And also I've spent some of it, a lot of it, on things that I'm really proud of, but don't talk about. So
like what?
No. I'll tell you later. But I'm happy. I'm very happy with where my money went.
Yeah.
And still, like, I'm comfortable. I could be kind of relaxed about money if I didn't want to continue making art.
Yeah.
That's the thing. Like, if I went into a very early, like, I'm 42. If I went into
early retirement,
I'd have a couple relaxed years ahead of me. But still wanting to make art puts a lot on the line. And I'm always at risk of losing a lot of money. And I do.
Yeah, for sure.
Especially when I do things that are not, that I don't do to make money.
Right.
Which is what I do. So yes, you lose tens of thousands of euros or dollars.
Yeah.
And it goes fast.
And doing a non-commercial project, doing a side project. I mean, I have done so many projects that lost money.
Yeah.
Because I wanted to do them. And then a great thing about the Patreon is now when I get a wackadoodle idea, I just do it. I do it and hopefully it at least breaks even and doesn't lose money.
Yeah, that's what I'm hoping. Like it's like a safety net against the worst.
Yeah.
Like I'm touring with a 6-piece band, which of course I know is not necessary. And a lot of people have been telling me.
Necessary according to what?
Yes. Like the logic behind it is like, people love your lyrics. You could just do a very small thing and people would be happy. Yes, that's true. And maybe at some point I will do that too. But right now I feel like the shaman kind of, I want to have something that is funky and loud and
that's what you want.
Generates a lot of heat. That's what I want.
Yeah.
That's why I'm still doing it. If I weren't doing that, I could just write books.
Yeah.
So that's my motivation to be doing this right now. So I have 6 people on stage
that I feed
and there's 12 people that I travel with.
Yeah.
And I'm not the most robust person health-wise, so I'll get sick sometimes.
Yeah.
Very seldomly, and it'll cost me so much money. It's really bad.
Everybody still needs to get paid.
Yes. And like I've done tours that were so much fun and everybody made money except me.
Yeah, I've done those tours.
That happens a lot.
Yeah,
and people don't, music videos.
Yeah, and people don't understand this. I mean, they really, most people don't understand the basic economics of music.
Doing what we do.
Touring, music, album making, how expensive it is, how much work has to happen behind the scenes.
By other people. Like, you can make very, very cheap music videos. But you can make them if you exploit people.
Yeah.
That's the basic truth of it. If you don't pay your people, right.
One of the things that I've liked about the Patreon is that it is constantly, and one of the reasons I slave over the project pages and the blogs and gathering stories from everyone on the crew and putting up pictures and bios of everyone who worked on the video. And look, this is a picture of all 70 people who worked on the Drowning in the Sound video. And these are the people who made the food. And this is the person who filled the pool. And this is so people really get
the amount of work,
because otherwise you could be like, oh, it's five dancers and a bunch of water and probably a person holding a camera. And it's like, no.
Yeah. And 70. The job is to make it look like fun.
Right.
You don't want it to look like work, like the thing that you make.
So one of the things that I can do with the Patreon, it's like a win. When I made that video, which cost upwards of $100,000, I also just, you know, the video was going to come out. That was going to make money, because every time I put something out, I make money.
Yeah.
And we made, housekeeping.
There's a knock on the door.
Hello.
Maybe we'll just answer them real quick and tell them that I'll do it.
Okay.
You say something clever.
Judith is going to discuss the future of our podcast with housekeeping in the hotel. Stand by. Stand by for news. Standing by. She just bought us 30 minutes. Fuck yeah. She comes back triumphant. She's bought us 30 minutes more of podcasting.
Yes.
So I think there's like an underlying theme.
More than ego?
This is like a different thing, or it probably comes back to ego. But these are like the ones that you said weren't even worth considering. I think it's still very...
I know. All worth considering. But we don't need to go very far.
No. But I think the common theme is indecency. And there's a thing where people think, and you've talked about that a lot in The Art of Asking, is that people think it's kind of indecent. Like, it's indecent for me because I've already made money. It's indecent.
False.
Yeah, false. But it's indecent for anybody to be asking for money.
False.
It's, yes, totally. But I think it's kind of interesting to look at it, because I have a hunch that this might be even worse in Germany. I don't know if you can say anything to that, but you've lived in Germany for a year.
So when we first met and started talking about crowdfunding, I told you that when I was doing a lot of press in 2012, because all of a sudden, you know, the wider mainstream media was very interested in this Kickstarter story.
Yeah.
And the German media was the most skeptical.
Reserved.
Well, no, just the most skeptical, the most suspicious.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we don't understand. Why would you be doing this? And I have to say, like, I don't look at the statistics. I'm not even sure I can. I probably can.
To see how many German backers you have?
To see how many German patrons I have.
Patrons you have.
You know, and the internet can be kind of weird. I often gauge how many patrons I have from, like, you know, are people tweeting me? Are they, you know, responding to this post that they're coming to the show in Offenbach? And when I showed up in Offenbach, no one was really talking about the show on the internet. You know, it had sold okay, but it wasn't sold out. And I wanted to arrange. So one of the things I'm trying to do every night is arrange a picture somewhere with the patrons.
Yeah, it's really nice.
And I arranged a photograph to take a picture with the patrons in Offenbach. And I thought that it would be maybe like 5 to 10 people.
Okay. And it was a lot. I've seen the picture.
It was like 100 people.
Yes.
And I was like, who are you guys? Where did you come from? And, you know, and also I had a lot of Kickstarter backers like come to my party in Berlin. I did a big Kickstarter party in Berlin. One of the house parties that I sold on Kickstarter was to, you know, a backer in Wiesbaden. And like all these Germans came to this place in
That's
the middle
great.
Of, it wasn't even in Wiesbaden, it was like Aufs Land.
Mm-hmm.
This girl had a dad who ran a beer brewery, and they emptied out this giant, you know, Saal full of beer kegs, and the tour bus literally pulled up.
How very German.
It was so Deutsch, and it was so awesome.
Yeah.
You know, and I think people here get it. It's not that they don't get it. I think someone like you has the fortitude and the grace.
Thank you.
To just go, I don't care whether or not you all understand this.
This is what I want to do.
I do.
Yeah.
I understand it. And there will be enough people out there who understand it. And that's enough.
I know that there's a lot of people who do understand. And there's, I think in Germany so far, the most successful people on Patreon or like other platforms are bloggers.
Yeah. Game reviewers.
Reviewers, that kind of thing. Yeah. YouTubers. Because they have a community that understands the internet.
Yes.
And that'll help. And I think I have a pretty, like, in the best way, nerdy audience that I love very much. Yeah. So I'm very confident that it'll kind of work. But the thing is, like, you've had so much backlash about, like, money just makes people aggressive. And if you do something that's out of the expected,
especially when you're a woman,
it'll trigger a lot of aggression.
Yeah.
But in America, you have a different ethos, I think, towards money, a little bit different.
Don't be so sure.
I'm not so sure. That's why I'm asking. But yeah. I think that, like, as seen from here, from over the pond, it looks like Americans are, like, basically pro money. And if you sit down with somebody in New York, the subject of money will come up very fast. And people are kind of uninhibited about money. It's like, how much money do you make? That's awesome. And Germans are way more, like, secretive about money. And there's something indecent about talking about money and making money and wanting to make money. And it's even more indecent to be rich. And there's a lot of shame connected
to
money.
In America, it's very regional. Where I grew up, it was very tasteless to discuss money. That was something that the Nouveau Riche did.
Yeah.
You know, I come from an old school New England Puritan town where, like, idle hands are the devil's workshop kind of shit.
Yeah.
You know, and then you go down to New York where, like, everything's hustle and everything's really fast and people will discuss money or not discuss money, but it doesn't fucking matter because no one has any time because everyone's just, like, killing it. And then you go to the West Coast where you are literally, like, everything is very, very, very money-based and hierarchy, and, like, people will literally look at the car you drive.
Oh, yeah?
Oh, my God. I mean, L.A., especially the entertainment industry. And, of course, I'm generalizing, and everything is everywhere. But, you know, America is gigantic. Don't forget how big the country is.
That's true.
Compared to Germany, population-wise, size-wise, attitudinally. It's almost like America is 20 different countries in terms of morals, ethics, attitudes, customs. And one of the things that I would warn you about, because I feel like it will inevitably happen, is that you will have...
It'll probably have happened once this airs.
Yeah. Okay.
Right?
So what's going to happen?
Yeah.
And I'm going to... Here's my crystal ball. I'm going to predict that what's going to happen is that if this is even remotely successful... which it will be, because your community will probably wrap its arms around you really tight.
Yeah.
You may have to go on a ride that you don't want to go on with the media.
Of explaining.
Because Der Spiegel will call and say, oh my God, you're doing this new thing. It's a new business model. We want to understand it. We are sending a photographer. We're sending a reporter. We're going to put you on the cover.
It's not that new. I don't know if it'll trigger that kind of...
Patronage is...
Newer.
Is newer. Or whatever. And still, they won't know the right questions to ask. Still, they're going to still be asking... I'm like looking at your note cards. They're still going to be asking the wrong questions and doing the wrong research and trying to keep the conversation around the wrong topics. Your job as a Jedi Knight, which I didn't know in 2012, and I just blithely tried to explain again and again
to
the New York Times, to Time Magazine, to Forbes, to all of the magazines who came calling going, oh my God, this is the future of the industry and da-da-da.
Yeah.
What I wish I had done or wish I had known is that they were asking all the wrong questions and that I had every right to explain
what you wanted,
what I wanted to explain,
yes,
and that even their questions showed
how stuck in the system they were.
But that's the thing, like whenever you do something that is kind of out of the matrix of how people talk about things.
They only have matrix language to discuss.
The language isn't there.
Right.
And yeah.
There's no spoon.
There's no spoon. That's it. Like we're nearing the end of this.
Yeah.
And I think we have to do it again. But I look at my cards, so I don't forget anything. Oh yeah, that's just one thing that I wanted to mention. Like in the way that your patrons support you and you keep them very close. For people who are not acquainted with Amanda's work, she keeps her fans very close. And I love it. And I'm one of those fans. And it's good for the heart. And you should all try it. The one thing that it's also good for, I think, is that you train your people to expect change. Because the closer you keep your people, the easier it is for them to follow you into weird places and follow you into the dark, because nothing comes unexpected.
Yeah.
Right. And I think that's so soothing for an artist to not be like working on something that is really weird and different from what you've done before. And then a year later, you'll be like, does anyone like it?
Yeah.
You know, it's just safer. And
so there's another danger, and this is a deep hidden danger. And you and I were discussing this the other day in Berlin, and this is an ego problem. I have run into the frightening territory that people care about me way more than they care about my art.
The art. Yeah.
And I find that incredibly disturbing sometimes. Mm. And this is the worst, you know, darkest ebb of crowdfunding, is that you can feel that dangerous territory that, like, maybe this is charity. Maybe people really don't like my music, my poetry, my offering, and they just think I'm so nice, and they care about me and my family, and they just want me to be happy. And, you know, but they're not actually downloading the track that I sent.
Yeah.
Uh-oh.
Like, I can see that hurting.
What's going on here? And what's so funny is that it's such a paradox. It's such a paradox that you would be sitting there thinking, I think that there's this danger that maybe problem is people just care about me.
But I think...
that's a problem. That's hilarious when you
think they about care it. About... I mean, it just makes me wonder, like, where you place your book.
Yes.
In the hierarchy of your art. Because all those people care about you in a very deep way, and the stuff that you have given them, which is also your art.
And it's the past... And then there's the future. And I will tell you the trick I use. And I have given this trick to a bunch of artists who have joined Patreon and slammed into the wall of, what the fuck?
Why is nobody downloading the stuff that they can?
Why are only 20% of my patrons downloading my song, my video, my work? And I remind them, and I don't know how well this trick works if you're not an American and you don't understand this particular system. Mm-hmm. But in America, we have National Public Radio, NPR, and it's like the BBC.
It's really good.
Yeah, it's fantastic programming. It's very liberal. It is a like super fact-based, truth-based reporting. You know, it's been around for decades.
They have the tiny desk things.
They have the tiny desk. There's, I mean, NPR is massive. They have a huge building in Washington, D.C. They do some of the most important political reporting in the country. And it's listener funded.
Yeah.
Some of the funding comes from the government, very little. A lot of the funding comes from sponsorship, and they don't ever play ads. They just have the announcers read the ads from scripts, which is an important part of the system. And then they do fundraisers all year, and everyone who listens gives $10, $500, $5,000, and it's community supported free press radio. And what I point out to the artists like me, whose egos freak out when they realize that even if they have 10,000 patrons, that only 2,000 of them are actually tuning in, is that not everybody has to tune in all the time.
That's
and
true.
Even though I'm giving my $500 to NPR every year, I'm not sitting by the radio making sure I get my money's worth. Mm-hmm. I just want it to exist for everybody.
Yeah, and Amanda Radio.
And I want it to be there when I'm driving so I can turn it on and listen to the news. Yes. When they're doing the financial marketplace show, I change the channel. But it doesn't mean that I don't love it and want it to be there. And that is the mindset that you have to get into egotistically as an artist to be like, it's okay. People are just paying me to survive and broadcast. And they will tune in when they're able and they won't when they're not. But far be it from me to take an egotistical hit because these people want to pay me to broadcast. Fuck that. That is actual winning.
Yes.
It's actual winning when someone trusts you so much.
They want you to do it even if it's for other people.
Exactly.
It's a community.
And this also follows on the point that a lot of people can't afford to support me on Patreon. And a lot of rich people can afford to give me $100 a month. And those people cover the students and the people who are broke and who just lost their jobs because all the content's free. And we take that for granted. Mm-hmm. The internet is so free. You listen to a song on YouTube, you listen to it on Spotify. Nothing's fucking free. And at the end of the day, if someone is listening to an artist's content for free, it has to get paid for somehow, somewhere, by someone.
Yeah. And in that case, it's the people who can.
And in that case, it's the people who can. And it is, you know, to each according to their need and to each according to their ability. It is social. It's a socialist art system, basically, that totally works. And it also gives those patrons who know that they are paying for the community to be able to access the art, for the artist to be able to survive. It gives them so much pleasure.
Yeah.
To know that they're doing
That's it. One thing, like maybe, and to end this lovely podcast that if it were up to me would go on forever. It's a lot of fun being your patron. I have been your patron for 5 years, I think. And I have actually upped my patronage, which is something that you can do, right? You can, like, I started low and then I made it more because I wanted more of the cool stuff. And that's how it feels to me. It's more like a media outlet. You support somebody knowing that they are an art facilitator in themselves. Like, they make art, they make other people's art happen. You support them because you want to be a part of that thing.
Yeah.
And it's so much fun. Like, sometimes you won't have the time to listen to every song, or sometimes it's even things like you are on the road and Amanda posts something new and you don't have the internet capacity to do it right now. And then you forget. It's like the internet works like that.
Right.
Right. And like, I binge.
Yeah.
Right. I'll do the all things and I'll check out everything you have done when you send out your all things newsletter, that kind of.
Yeah. The monthly subsumizes digest.
The monthly digest. Maybe a lot of people do that. Yeah. So it's a lot of fun. I recommend it highly to everybody. And I think we'll come to an end and we'll go over to the giant theater.
Oh my God.
That you will be playing.
The giant theater made of tonight. Stone. Made of cement.
Oh, there's one last thing I want to talk about, urgency. A little bit, tiny little bit. Mm. Because I noted from your wonderful art book that you have, that is also a patron thing, mm-hmm. Patreon thing. You quoted somebody else saying your doula, like your book doula, mm-hmm. who told you, you can do anything, but you can't do everything, mm-hmm. which is something that I should put up on a wall behind my desk. And I was just wondering, like, as a last question, mm-hmm. how do you choose now that everything seems possible?
How did you ever choose?
It's difficult. But a lot of choices were made for me. That's what I mean. Like, a lot of choices I had somebody bully me into.
Sure.
By necessity.
I think.
By citing necessity.
One of the most enjoyable parts of growing as an artist has been learning the art of the improvisational decision.
Yeah. Winging it.
Winging it and winging it and getting very good at not looking back and just saying, I am going to make not the right decision and not the wrong decision. I'm just going to make
a decision. And I'm going to stick with it and
that's
do it.
The decision. Let's go. It doesn't matter what's behind us on the road. It doesn't matter if buildings are burning. We're just heading that way. And one of the things that I love so much about the Patreon is that it supports that style of thinking.
Yeah.
It supports that style of regret-free art making because it is not about profit. It's not about charts. It's not about sales. It's not about an outside measurement of success. It's just about process.
Yes, that's it.
And the fact that the process actually is, and for me, fucking always has been, the fun part.
Yes.
Not the product.
Yeah.
And since Patreon gives you a wide berth to land, really nothing can go wrong because you can write a jokey song that you think might go viral on the internet. And if it crashes and burns, it doesn't matter. You're on to the next thing. And you do this and you want to write a poem and you want to make a video and you want to do a covers album and you want to make a record with your dad and you want to make a record with your old hero from the legendary Pink Dots and you know it's going to sell no copies, but it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter because you're doing it because you want to do it. So there has never been a better system for an artist who doesn't have a plan, but has constant ideas and has impulsive ideas and doesn't want to have to wait 18 months to have like run all of the marketing strategy and the budget to figure out if this is a worthy idea.
Yeah, it'll take out all the steam and it'll make you not do a lot of things. Yeah.
So you really get to skip the hurdle of practicality. And as an artist who hates practicality,
yeah.
It's such an enjoyable ride. And I would say, I mean, you could look at my whole Patreon as kind of like, it's a Gesamtkunstwerk.
Yes.
That's everything.
It is the piece of art.
Like literally from the reporting to the photographs, to the talking about how difficult the process was, how amazing the process was, how fucked up the process got, how, you know, that is the artwork. And that's the ride that everyone is paying to go on with me, to support me. Just like you couldn't say if you're supporting NPR for $500 that there is this one single product that you get to take home and put on a shelf. It's just a stream of, you know, well-intentioned broadcasting.
Yeah. You want it to be in the world.
You want it to be in the world and you want its voice in the world. And this is where I get really inspired and lit up by the idea of what Patreon could do. Because if you're going to hurdle past the media, the marketplace, the gatekeepers, the commercial, you know, the commercial middlemen, if we're just talking in this world right now about whose voices we need to listen to and we want to listen to, but they're very hard to find because they don't sell, because they're not pretty, because, you know, they're not just offering up something sugary that everybody wants to consume, but we know that we want them
and need them
if we're going to survive and figure out a way to interconnect this planet that makes it sustainable. This system will help do that. This system will reward truth instead of superficiality. This system will give a tool to the communities who want to support, especially in America, women, minorities, the poor, the people who have stories to tell but do not have keys to the castle. Mm-hmm. This is going to give them keys.
Yeah.
Because you don't need 5,000 people to be able to make a decent living as a podcaster.
You need very 50. Few people to make great things. You don't need everybody. You need the right people.
And so once the shame and the stigma, I think, gets filed off of this system, you know, I think it's going to hopefully explode against and in resistance to the other explosion that's happened with, like, your YouTubers and Instagram influencers. Because the money that is fueling that is blood money.
Yeah.
It's all corporate sponsored, ad sponsored, you know, sale based, product based, not unsustainable content. And this is providing an alternative that is not about planet destroying. It's about planet saving. And yeah. hopefully that this car is going to overtake that car running on clean energy instead of on the blood money of I am here to influence you into buying a fucking soda.
Yeah, it's the idea of interbeing, basically. It's everybody needs to understand that nobody is separate from anybody and anything on this planet. It applies to everything. And we start here. Do you want to...
Fang mal on.
Do you want to say bye-bye to people in German? Because you can, and people will be very impressed.
Ja, freilich.
Amanda lived in Regensburg.
Ich habe in Bayern gewohnt.
Ja.
Yeah. Viel Spaß. Tschüss. Vielen Dank. Es war wunderbar. Es war super. Judith, sehr gut Podcasting Hostess.
Dankeschön.
Hoffentlich machen wir noch einer und noch eins und noch eins und wir sollen... We should do daily podcast. Me and Judith, daily podcast about like the state.
Waldorf and Stadler.
About the state of the ego and patronage in Germany. Deutsches Amerikanisches Freundschaft.
Yes.
Über Crowdfunding.
Yes. Crowdfunding.
Crowdfunding.
Okay.
Oh my God.
Yes.
Is that, did that
That's
just
what
come
I'm
up?
Doing.
You are doing crowdfunding.
Oh my crowdfunding. God. Okay. Bye-bye, everyone.
I'm so proud Cheers. Of you. And I love you all. And I hope that as soon as Judith gets this going, you are all totally 100% on Team Judith.
Thank you so much.
Crowdfunders. Bye.
Bye. Thank you for listening to this very emotional and, at least for me, transformative episode of Salon Holofernes. If you happened to like this show, watch out for more episodes in English. I will do them. If you follow me on any of my social media, I am going to make sure to keep you posted. Also, as you might have guessed, I have, in fact, joined Patreon. And yes, my stuff is mainly in German, but there's quite a few people who attempt to learn German with me, listening to my music, have been over the years. And they seem to enjoy it, so maybe that's for you. But also, if you don't speak German, I have quite a few international fans, and I do try my best to make them happy. So you can check out my music. It's on all the platforms under Judith Holofernes or Judith Holofernes. Also, as soon as I reach 50 non-German-speaking patrons, I am going to add English Q&As and translations of my blog posts to the list of stuff my patrons get. This might have already happened as you are listening to this. So for you to join up would make me very, very happy, as like most artists from non-English speaking countries, I still love for my stuff to travel, and who knows, I might just travel with it. So thank you and speak to you soon.
drei, zwei, drei, vier, was man.